Coming up right now is Animal Voices, and some of our animal friends are joining us in the studio. They've just fit in because they are elephants and they're really big, but we can fit a couple of them in, and here we go.
Welcome everyone to Animal Voices and those with the sounds of the elephants. Each time a person stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, these ripples build a current that can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. Those were the words of Robert F. Kennedy. Animal Voices, in our program, we seek to enlighten the public about animal-related causes. We do this by presenting and producing radio programs that deliver a message that inspires people to improve the lives of animals. Animal Voices is dedicated to exposing and challenging the terror perpetrated every day by our society against billions of innocent, sentient, non-human animals. Yes, this is Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio, 102.7 FM in Vancouver, your commercial-free, community-based, and community-sponsored radio station. This program is presented to you by volunteer members of the Vancouver Humane Society, EarthSafe Canada, and the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society. The views expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect the views of those organizations involved. Alan Jensen is in the control room. My name is Carl Loskin. And in studio today, we have John Pranger, our webmaster, and Marge Adams, who is a member of the Vancouver Humane Society. Shortly, Marge will be speaking with Deborah Probert from the Vancouver Humane Society about the latest BC avian flu situation. Then we will contact Gloria Groh. She is the co-founder of the Fauna Foundation, and we'll hear about the chimpanzee sanctuary close to Montreal. Wonderful people. Then John Pranger will inform us about compulsory vaccinations and the coming tyranny. We'll also have a letter from Joanne Chang, who is presently at the farm sanctuary in California, and three announcements about coming up events. And now, over to Marge.
Oh, thank you for that, Carl. Hello, Deborah. Are you there? Deborah? Hi, Deborah.
Yes.
Welcome to Animal Voices.
Thank you, Marge.
Deborah, we want to ask you a few questions about the avian flu situation. First of all, this virus has existed for a long time, and I'm wondering what your feelings are towards the governments. Are they overreacting?
Well, we're concerned about what's going to be happening in the next few months. What we found is that internationally, governments are considering increasingly radical measures to contain the virus, and some of the methods that they're saying are keeping domestic birds indoors, away from wild birds, culling flocks at the first sign of a harmless strain of flu, which has happened here in BC. They're talking about draining wetlands, culling wild populations of birds, and obviously stockpiling masses of expensive drugs that, you know, they're of questionable efficacy. But we really are concerned about that, and we think that before we impose such drastic methods, we should really look at the root cause of the problem.
And what do you think the root causes are?
Well, I think that the root cause of the virulence of this particular virus definitely has something to do with the fact that we have such extreme numbers of animals in so densely packed populations. In avian flu circulates in wild birds at low levels anyway and doesn't cause illness. Natural selection plays an important role in regulating wildlife populations. But when you get a virus like this into, for instance, a barn, where you have 35,000 individuals that are basically genetically identical, then that virus goes through like wildfire. And the problem with that is, aside from the welfare and health issues, is that that virus then has the opportunity to mutate so many more times than it would have naturally in the wild. So we know that it exacerbated the problem in 2004 with the avian flu, that there were so many birds in such confined spaces, and there were so many barns in a relatively small area. The industry is very densely compacted here in the Fraser Valley. So, and it's obvious even from what's happening overseas that the intensification of animal agriculture is a definite factor.
And now, why is the disease suddenly getting such an alarmed reaction?
Well, I think the reason is that it's popping up in so many places, and because of the likelihood that it's going to jump the species barrier and cause illness in human beings. And I think that there's justification. Obviously, I'm not a scientist, but again, because of the intensification of poultry agriculture, not just here in North America, but in Asia as well, there's definitely more likelihood that that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Now, we had that outbreak in 2004. It had a killing off of just thousands and thousands of birds. Now, millions, was it? Millions of birds, 17 million or something. Now, that, did the organic free-range birds demonstrate any greater resistance to that flu?
Well, it just didn't hit them. I don't have the figures for both, but I do know that only one backyard flock tested positive out of something like 400 to 500 that were tested. And that one flock only tested positive after a factory farm across the street tested positive. So it's absolutely obvious that backyard and free-range flocks are not the problem. They didn't pick up the flu. They don't get it. I think what we don't realize here in North America, we think of Asia as having very different farming practices, and up until very recently they did. But in Asia, although the situation is somewhat different in terms of the coexistence of people with animals, it's been admitted scientifically that there is a problem with intensification of poultry, and that is contributing to the problem there. It's a big contributor. In fact, the agriculture, the AIO, I believe it's called, has the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, has listed 6 contributing factors. 3 of those have to do with an increase of poultry populations and intensification of poultry production. So it's obvious that while there definitely was a problem because of the close proximity of people and animals and the different types of birds mixing together in the markets, intensification of agriculture is a major, major exacerbation of the situation.
And how many humans have actually caught the disease? Do you have any knowledge on that?
The last I saw yesterday was 30 in China. Apart from that, I couldn't give you any other figures.
Mm-hmm. Now, another area. What do you think about the decrease or prevention of outbreaks? How would you work on this problem?
Well, I'm not a scientist, and no. I'm not a veterinarian,
uh-huh.
and I wouldn't begin to offer a solution. But we certainly would like to see. Unfortunately, it's this terrible lust we have for eggs and for animal protein that's gotten us into this mess in the first place. So obviously the answer is, in the long term, a reduction in the use of animal protein and a reduction in the dependence on it. And what we would like to see as well is more organic farms, more organic and free-range farms. We'd like to see labeling in the marketplace so that the consumer could make an educated choice when they go to spend their dollars and decide what they're buying. And one of the examples of that is our Chicken Out project. We want to see, we've asked Loblaw if they will label all of their eggs from caged hens as eggs from caged hens. And then when a consumer goes to the grocery store, they can immediately decide whether that's something that they want to contribute to or whether they would rather support a free-range or certified organic system.
Mm-hmm. And that is having some success, isn't it, that program?
We have had a great deal of success all the way from our exposé in October, on October the 13th, of an egg farm in Ontario, to just more recently yesterday when we sent a press release out telling the public that Pamela Anderson, who's going to be here for the Grey Cup this weekend, has endorsed our request of Loblaw to label all of their eggs from caged hens. So we're extremely happy about that, and it's certainly putting some major pressure on Loblaw.
Wonderful. Now, Carl has a question.
Yes, Deborah. This modern poultry industry has created, I believe, an environment very favorable to highly contagious agents. And also, one of the aspects of this is that intensive selection for production traits has left these birds, their immune system, compromised. And now scientists are discovering more and more these immunosuppressive microbes. So together with the disastrous effect of this rapid rate growth of chickens, maybe you can just add something to that.
Well, it's absolutely true. The limited genetic diversity of the birds and the way they're raised is a major problem. For instance, all the chickens bred for meat in North America are basically the same breed. And they're bred specifically to crave food and to grow at an accelerated rate. They're certainly not looking at other traits that happen as a byproduct of this breeding for production. In egg-laying hens, for instance, they've accidentally managed to breed a very nervous bird. This wasn't something they bargained for or something they even care about, but what it's resulted in is the fact that these birds are suffering even more because they're not only in intensive situations in crammed into cages with each other and unable to exhibit any natural behavior, but they're a very, very nervous bird as well, so it just adds to the problem.
So now, would you say that antibiotics and vaccines are of very limited use in preventing this disease?
Well, I think that it's what I'm seeing in the news internationally is that the vaccine of the birds itself is really a waste of time because the virus is mutating faster than they can vaccinate for it.
Now, John has a question.
Deborah, I heard this morning on a CBC report, which was incomplete because they had technical difficulties, so I didn't hear the full report, but that Quebec has ordered all fowl indoors and that the other provinces are thinking of doing the same thing. Have you heard that?
Yes, I have. I was afraid you were going to ask me about that. I don't really have too much of a comment on that, other than to say that in the UK, this is starting to happen in Europe.
Yes, I've heard that too.
And the Compassion in World Farming has actually issued a policy statement, and what they've said is that they understand that this may be something that is necessary in the short term, but that it would be absolutely unacceptable to do that in the long term. And I think that if we look at what we're doing, if we have to take such drastic measures with our food source, something is terribly, terribly wrong if we're fighting nature for our very food. If we have to take all of our birds and put them indoors, and I can personally only see that that's going to make things worse because it's going to cause birds that are more robust to become less robust. They're not going to have the exposure that they would have outside to build up immunity and to pass that immunity on. And from a layman's perspective, with the very limited knowledge that I have, it looks to me like that is going to, if it's done in the long term, certainly going to cause major problems. But of course, from the Vancouver Humane Society's point of view, it's the welfare issue, and we don't want to see birds inside. We want to see them outside, but certainly we don't want to endanger public health either.
Well, public health is much more endangered, it seems to me, with factory farming than with organic farming. And if this is a ruse or a behind-the-scenes effort at destroying the industry, it could be very effective.
It's hard to say. My understanding is at the moment that the Canadian Food Inspection Agency has a very hands-off attitude towards backyard flocks and free-range and organic flocks, simply because there was no reason for them to be touched last time. They shouldn't have had to have killed as many as they did. They just weren't showing that they were problematic with the disease. So from that point of view, I think that it's very obvious scientifically that this is not a problem. I really don't know what's going to happen in the future, and we're waiting, just like everybody else is, to see what's going to happen.
The farmer, I believe his name is Ken Falk, whose crop is being destroyed, or whose geese are being destroyed, 60,000 birds, I believe, thinks that it's all nonsense, and that they take biohazard precautions, and that this flu could not have been contagion from wild birds. So he thinks the CFIA, is acting completely illogically and unwarranted, taking unwarranted actions here.
I think that the farmers are probably in a better position to comment on that than I am. Our immediate concern is the method of slaughter. They are using CO2 again, and we have been repeatedly asking CFIA to change the method, particularly for long-necked birds such as ducks, because it's not the most humane method, and in fact, last time round in 2004 was very, very problematic in welfare terms. We are really, really adamant that they change to another gas that is readily available, possibly more expensive, but since ducks don't constitute a large number in the scheme of things, I don't think that it's something that we should ignore.
I guess we're out of time now, Deborah. Thank you so much for being on the show today and enlightening us on the avian flu issue.
Thank you so much, Marge.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Welcome. Yes, it's Animal Voices. You've been listening to Deborah Probert and Marge Adams speaking about the avian flu, and there's been an incident here, and they're killing the ducks in the Fraser Valley here. Well, we have a bit of music. And then we'll have also, as I said before, we have three event coming up. And we have now Raffi on the line, the children's troubadour, Where We All Belong. And over to Alan Jensen.
Mm-hmm. Tunza! In this world of wonder, circle where we all belong, voice of a thousand tribes,
Tunza,
circle where we all belong,
where we all belong,
pulse of the human heart,
Tunza,
circle where we all belong. Free circle where we all belong,
where we all belong,
where we all belong,
where we all belong.
Land and sea, every flower, every tree makes a circle
where we all belong.
Every bird, every cloud, every raindrop that falls makes a circle
where we all belong.
Every turn of the tide, every ocean wave makes a circle
where we all belong.
Every breeze that blows, every green
grain of sand makes a circle in the sun,
where we all belong.
In this world of wonder, circle where we all belong.
Where we all belong.
Voice of a thousand tribes, circle where we all belong.
Where we all belong.
Pulse of the human heart, circle where we all belong.
You've been listening to Rafi, and the song was Where We All Belong. And he expresses the Swahili sentiment called Tunza, and that means to treat with care and affection where we all belong. You're listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. Our program is presented at noon on Fridays and repeated on Mondays at 4 p.m. Heard live on the internet at www.coopradio.org. And join our webmaster posts many of these programs on our webpage, which is www.animalvoices.org. Gloria Groh is the co-founder of the Fauna Foundation, and responsible for Canada's only chimpanzee sanctuary, located outside of Montreal. Hello, Gloria.
Hello there. How are you today?
Good, and happy to have you online. You know,
yes, I'm happy to be here. What an appropriate song before we start talking about chimpanzees.
Yes, be kind, like Ingrid Newkirk always says, too. It also fits in there.
Yeah.
Now, it's quite amazing that you have a chimpanzee sanctuary in Montreal, Canada's only. And maybe you can tell us what you do there and what it's all about.
Well, what we do here is look after chimpanzees that have been used and, you know, taken from their lives in the wild, put into biomedical research. Some of them were actually in entertainment before they ended up in the laboratory, and then others were actually born in the laboratory. And this particular laboratory in New York State ended up closing, and there was a desperate need to find homes for certain individuals that were living in the laboratory, and we were able to provide a home for 15 chimpanzees at that time, which is actually a very small number compared to the number of chimpanzees that need retirement and need a life after research.
Now, the need is, in fact, much greater than, I believe you have 13 chimpanzees there.
Yeah.
How many chimpanzees are being used in laboratories, pharmaceutical and medical?
There's over 1,500 that we know of. You know, it's quite difficult to track a lot of chimpanzees down, especially if you're part of military testing or anything that has sort of the secrecy kind of code. You know, there's a lot that are registered and we can account for, but there's so many that we cannot find and track down, which is, you know, rather horrifying, really, when you think about it.
Now, the I can hear the chimpanzees in the background. Is that
yes,
the noise?
Yes, you can. You're in the chimp house now, and they're having their dinner served to them right now.
Chomp,
so
chomp.
You'll hear different noises because some of them want their dinner quicker. Tonight they're having boiled cabbage and soy milk. So.
Oh, great. Now, How comes these were discarded by the these wonderful chimps, discarded by the industry, and you came to get them and rescued them? How did they get into your hands?
Well, that was actually sort of, I think that, as I look back on it, I think it was fate and destiny for me, and also fate and destiny for them. You know, normally laboratories do not retire their chimpanzees. There is now, you know, a law that says you must retire chimpanzees, but only certain ones are being retired. You know, they need to be protected, and that's exactly what the campaign that we're working on is all about, trying to make sure that chimpanzees, if they are used in biomedical research, that they do end up having a chance at a life after retirement. And these individuals, this was, and one of the people that I'm working on a campaign with is a lady named Nancy Megna, who actually worked in the laboratory with the chimpanzees. And there are some people in laboratories that actually have tremendous amount of respect and concern about the fate and the future of chimpanzees that are living in the laboratories. And in the situation with the chimpanzees that are in my care, Dr. James Mahoney, a veterinarian that worked with these chimpanzees, could not allow or accept in his mind that these guys would be murdered or just sent off to another laboratory after their use. You know, he felt that they deserved a life afterwards. He worked very hard and tried for 2 or 3 years to get as many as he could out of his laboratory, and he basically smuggled chimpanzees out of his laboratory, which is quite exceptional for, you know, someone who works in a laboratory to do, although there are a lot of situations we're hearing about, you know, especially concerning monkeys, for example, where, you know, people that work in the laboratories do try to do things like that, but with chimpanzees it's rather difficult. So this laboratory happened to be closing because of substandard housing, and you know, out of 250 chimpanzees, only about 90 of them made it into retirement. The rest of them went off for further research. And unfortunately, the majority of them ended up at what you would consider one of the worst laboratories in the United States at that time, and that was the Colson Foundation. And there they would be subjected to toxicology. And that's basically what you do with anyone who is no longer useful to you at a certain time in their life, and that's poison you to death, because you can be any age and be poisoned to death. And we were the first people in the world, actually, to rescue HIV-positive chimpanzees, so that was already sort of rather scandalous and unusual at the time. The chimps, of course, have eliminated the virus, the ones that are living with us, which is also kind of, you know, it's on one hand, it's wonderful and amazing and incredible that they've done that they've somehow managed to no longer be positive. But it's also extremely sad and horrible to think about the billions and billions of dollars that have been spent to do AIDS research using these individuals in particular.
I just want to emphasize what you've said here now, that they tried to infect these chimpanzees with the HIV virus, and mm-hmm. they did not come down with it.
No, in fact, Tom, I'm going to talk about Tom Chimpanzee. He spent the longest time of all the chimps that we have living here with us now in the laboratory. He spent over 30 years in the laboratory, and I was just looking at his medical files, actually, and in 1987, they started to infect him with different strains of the HIV virus, many, many different strains. They literally strapped him down on a table and took the blood of an infected human being and injected it into Tom's veins. And month after month, and sometimes maybe 3 or 4 month intervals, they would reinfect him or re-challenge him. And when Tom moved in here in 1997, 10 years later, he was considered an infected chimpanzee. He was HIV positive. He no longer is HIV positive. So clearly something's going on there. I mean, I don't really know. I'm just the chimp mummy. I do what I do. I look after the chimps. I try to, you know, treat them with dignity and respect and provide. It's basically a hospice here. You know, obviously the chimpanzees that are living here have all had so much research done on them that there's really not much normal about the insides of their bodies. On the outside, looking at them, you know, when they moved in, of course, they all looked quite different than they do now. They hadn't seen sunlight in years, had never been outdoors at all. If they were born in the laboratory, they'd never been out. They, you know, some of them had pulled their hair out one by one, one hair after another. They're living in solitary confinement in the laboratories in 5 by 5 by 7 foot cages and have absolutely nothing to do. And they have a very bland type of diet. So a lot of them were very pale in color. Their hair was virtually missing. I mean, to see an adult male chimpanzee with no hair, it's, you know, they actually look like a human being standing there. I mean, it's alarming, really. You know, I mean, we tend to want to say that chimpanzees are so like us, but in actual fact, chimpanzees were here a long time before we were, and we are so like them. And so for us to continue to try and prove that chimpanzees are just like humans is such a, you know, I just don't understand. I personally have a hard time understanding why these studies can, you know, go on and on trying to prove the intelligence of chimpanzees. I mean, chimpanzees have survived and managed to look after, you know, a whole tribe of chimpanzees, look after their families, raise their young, you know, managed to travel 30 kilometers in the forests of Africa and take care of a family. They've done pretty darn well on their own, you know, and I don't think it's very fair to compare their intelligence to, you know, a four-year-old child, for example, because take a four-year-old child and ask him to survive, him or her to survive, you know, in the forests of Africa, and I don't think they'd fare very well. But and we tend to test chimpanzees by giving them, you know, computers and different things like that, and see whether or not they can, you know, master these challenges. Well, I don't really think that's a very fair thing to do, you know.
Now, I'd like to get back to this HIV issue here,
mm-hmm.
because you talked about Tom, who was went through all these injections of blood with which was from infected people,
mm-hmm.
and the different strains,
yes,
and
absolutely.
Then he overcame it.
Mm-hmm.
And surely this shows to us the questionable science of using animals as experiments, where they would be so different to us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I don't even know what to say to that, because you've just said it. It's so questionable. Everything is questionable. I mean, it's so difficult to say to people, please stop doing this to chimpanzees or to animals, because, yes, so as much as they are like us, they're still so, so very, very different, you know, and we're just really in, you know, it's really, really, really hard to, I'm faced with this argument all the time. People will say that I care more about chimpanzees than I do about people because I don't want them to be used in research any longer. Well, that's certainly one, you know, one point. I do not want them to be used in research, but the point and the fact of the matter, and you'll see a lot of that with the campaign that we're going to be involved with, is different doctors and veterinarians and people who have done a lot of work with chimpanzees and other, primarily chimpanzees, because that's what we're going to be talking about, will prove over and over and over again that this is not good science.
And that's why I think the moral issue is really not very useful. We have to talk scientific, because it's a scientific claim. They say it's scientifically rational, and therefore the morals become a higher kind of moral than ordinary standards would permit.
Yeah, people don't really want to work on the moral end of things. We haven't got anywhere on that one.
That's right.
We're really getting nowhere. And fortunately and finally, you know, NEVS, the organization, New England Anti-Vivisection Society, has taken on the challenge, really, of proving and finding qualified people who can do this kind of, to prove, because it's been very difficult to prove that the science is poor. I mean, no one wants to challenge anyone on that, because you always look like you're, you know, you always look like the bad guy if you say, well, you can't use animals for this because it's not nice to use animals for this. Well, it isn't about that at all. It's about wasting money. It's about not really finding anything out that's, you know, of any validity. And you know, they're pretty much, I think, found out that more than, and if not more than half, at least half of the research that's been done hasn't given us anything. So, you know,
so
is
then
it worth it?
Research becomes actually dangerous because it's actually misleading people into making judgments that are invalid and applying it to human beings, which then could be, you know, lethal.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't, you know, yes.
So that's the argument that we have to use all the time.
That is the argument, and yeah. however you can help me get that across.
And there is never
using scientific information, and we do have people with science in their backgrounds involved in this project, Project R&R, and that's what we'll be talking about. I'm there to represent and talk about what has happened to these individuals and to introduce the chimpanzees that have been through this, and I have the medical files to prove what they've been through and to show, what's happened to them. And other than that, I mean, we need to rely on the doctors, the veterinarians, the people who have done this type of work, and they have to tell us how this is really, really insane and not right.
And do you know the book 1,000 Doctors, edited by Hans Ruch, the Swiss medical researcher?
No, I don't know.
1,000 Doctors Against Vivisection, which has statements by more than 1,000 doctors, actually, stating more or less the same thing, that it's impossible to extrapolate from animals to human beings, and that, therefore, the science is invalid and misleading and very, very dangerous, because you're applying results from animals to people with very dire consequences.
Well, and how many more doctors do we need saying that before we will believe it? That's the question, I guess.
Well, it's big business, and that's probably the problem right there.
And there you go. And that's exactly what I have learned myself personally, and with the fight and thinking that how on earth can people continue to do this to them, knowing what they go through and the moral and ethical end of it, and meeting the chimps and so on. But then looking at the industry itself. The industry itself is just, between the people that sell the animals, the people that sell the restraining devices, the people that sell the cages, the people that sell the food, it's a huge, huge industry, and it's not one that will just end tomorrow. And in actual fact, we all are quite aware of the fact, and that's part of the reason why, working with someone who did work in the laboratory, obviously initially I was rather aggressive towards anyone who did research, and I thought anyone who worked in the laboratory, was
evil.
Exactly. Thank you for saying that. I didn't want to be responsible for that. But then, the reality of it is, if every single animal that was in a laboratory were to be released tomorrow, there would be nowhere for them to go. And it's so valuable and so important for us to work with people who are working in the laboratories at this moment. And don't get me wrong here. Don't think that I want it to continue. I just realize that it's not going to end within a year or 10 years, perhaps, the use of animals in research. I was at
especially if the media has anything to say about it.
Well, yeah, but it's someone, I was at an alternatives conference in Berlin this summer, and there are so many alternatives out there now, and people just aren't using them. The laboratories aren't connected. I have a friend who's a veterinarian and my partner's a veterinarian, and, they're not even advised of these alternatives. They're not even told about these kind of things. So connecting everyone together is already very difficult, but it also puts people out of work. Of course, that's a really big problem. No one wants to put people out of work. But what we have realized is if tomorrow morning a lab worker, a person who works in a laboratory, goes into the laboratory and actually gives the individual in that cage some love, some enrichment, maybe gives them a chance to have social housing, maybe provides them with fresh fruits and vegetables, they will improve the quality of the life of that individual in the laboratory tomorrow. Where the work we're doing is a long-term type, job, where we're hoping that we can prove at least with one species, the chimpanzee we're starting with, because it is the smallest population right now of if we were to choose baboons, for example, there's just so many baboons in biomedical research, and pigs are personally my favorite animal, but the chimpanzee is one of the most incredible representatives. They really have bridged the gap between animals and humans, and they're amazing ambassadors, and so we just need to let them speak, and unfortunately they can't, well, now you're hearing them speak, but we need to speak on their behalf and try and get the point across and the message out that this is all so wrong.
Well, your suggestion might cover some of the welfare consideration, but it won't address the the problem of extrapolating from animals to human beings and trying to cure disease that way. It will never be done, and it only increases disease. So for the human population, we're in very dire straits, and I think abolition, immediate and unconditional, is what we need to stress.
Yes,
that'd be wonderful. Yes, absolutely. I agree completely with that. I guess I've just been a little disillusioned although I feel very positive about what we're doing. I just, you know, after working with the chimps it's going to be 8 years they've been here now, and I honestly thought when the chimps first moved in that people would say, oh my God, how could we do this to chimpanzees? How could we believe what they're telling us? How can we, you know, take these amazing beings and torture them in the way we have and do all this literally bullshit to them and expect that we're going to cure anything or save people's lives? You know, and still today there's people that stand there saying, you know, we need to sacrifice these chimpanzees to save other people's lives. And we all know that isn't going to happen.
That's a sophomoric approach.
Yeah.
Half wise, half stupid.
We're speaking with Gloria Grow. She's the co-founder of the Fauna Foundation, now responsible for Canada's only chimpanzee sanctuary. Well, you heard those chimpanzees munching on cabbages there, but they also have many animals. When we come back, we're going to ask Gloria about some of the stories of chimpanzees that have been rescued from research laboratories. So you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. Our webpage is www.animalvoices.org, and many of our programs are posted on our webpage. So it's a good place to go there. Now, the Fauna Foundation, it's spelled F-A-U-N-A Foundation. And you can look up, for those who'd like to look into this a little bit more, you can go to www.releasechimps.org and faunafoundation.org. And Gloria spoke about NEAVS, which actually is an acronym, and it means New England Anti-Vivisection Society. So welcome back to Animal Voices, Gloria. You know, we have a few minutes left here. Maybe you can just... I was looking at this poster. You're going to be in Seattle, of course. So
yes,
we do have many people who can listen to our program in the Bellingham area. And we'll just make that announcement quickly here, that on Thursday, December the 1st, at 7 p.m., you will be at the showroom at the Seattle Center, and you will be making a presentation there about these chimpanzees and using their own words. So that's many people from Bellingham would like to go down there. I know some who will be going down will have a first-hand opportunity of meeting you.
Yeah, and thank you for telling people about that. That's wonderful, and we really look forward to having people come and meet us and, you know, hear about the chimpanzees.
So now in the last few minutes, maybe, you know, I saw this poster that you have about the event in Seattle on December the 1st, Thursday,
mm-hmm.
and it showed the pictures of these five different chimps here. And what surprised me so much about it was that each chimp was so different. I mean, there's Norman, Pepper, Peggy, Sue Ellen, and each one was such a different expression. Tell us some of the stories just briefly that you'll be sharing with the people in Seattle.
Well, the type of stories I'll be sharing, and you're absolutely right, chimpanzees all are completely different. As unique as we are, they are as unique. They are different facial expressions, different ways they walk, different ways they communicate with one another. One of the stories I'm going to tell is of Tom. Tom, as I told you about earlier, was, you know, he's one of the oldest gents here. We're not exactly sure how old he is because he was caught in Africa, so he was, you know, stolen from his family in Africa, brought to America. We're not really sure where he spent the first years of his life because it's unknown. You know, those are the dark years where no one really knew where chimpanzees came from, but he likes to do things like put socks on his feet, so probably he was privately owned or in entertainment. And Tom, while he was in the laboratory, was actually being socialized with another adult male chimpanzee, and his foot was severely bitten by the other chimpanzee. And so you can imagine, you know, an adult male chimpanzee is at least 4 foot tall, and they weigh nearly 200 pounds. So imagine two guys like that in a 5 by 5 by 7 foot cage, you know, sort of meeting for the first time. And Tom actually had to stay back at the lab an extra 2 months. He couldn't come to our sanctuary because they were trying to, you know, fix the foot. At one time they thought they'd have to amputate his foot. And his foot is pink now, where it would normally be black. And it looks like as though he's a burn victim. You know, it's very thin skin, and it's very, very pink. And Tom has, you know, had to sort of live a little differently than the rest of the chimps because of this particular injury on his foot, because when he runs, he sort of bangs it on steel or he bangs it on something hard and it'll pop open. So he was always, you know, locked back up in a room and, you know, having to have his foot medicated and having to take antibiotics and so on. So clearly, after a while, he must have, in his mind, I don't know, you can't really think for chimpanzees, but, you know, he was always really bored in the room on his own. He didn't really like sharing his space with other chimpanzees. He had a hard time socializing. That's from living so many years on his own. And we started to get the chimps to paint, so they, you know, for something to do. I mean, we'd read about people giving chimpanzees paint and paintbrushes and canvases and so on, and Tom actually seemed to really quite enjoy doing that. And on one particular day, Tom actually was, you know, determined. We offer different colors of paint, and they get to choose the colors that they like to work with. And in this, on this day, there was a, we had those little tubs of paint. One was yellow, one was blue, one was black, and one was green. And the person that was working with Tom that day, and, you know, trying to get him to do a nice piece of art for us, she could not open the lid to the black container. He absolutely wanted the black one that day. She opened every other one, but the black one was stuck, and she couldn't open it. So she had the human male that works here, Pat, go over and you know, try and pry the top off. Well, when the top was off, Tom was so excited. He took that little tub of paint, brought it into his room with him, because we have portholes we could pass it, and he started to paint his pink foot. And, aww. Yeah, that's one of those things that they say chimpanzees cannot do, is recognize that they're different. And three of us were sobbing, because clearly he, for some reason, you know, he obviously thought that was probably why he was always locked in a room, separated from everyone, that he was different. And after that, we actually did something for him. We found a type of ink that you can put that safely on your skin. And Tom's foot was painted. We did it for him, and he let us do it. And for about 3 months, Tom had a black foot, and he seemed to, honestly, he went into the group. He didn't, you know, it seemed to change how he was with everyone else, and now he's okay. He doesn't need it painted anymore, and it was obviously, you know, and there's people that, you know, have phobias or think that they look different and they act different and so on. So I think that was a pretty clear, you know, The girl who was here doing it, she was a legal student, and, you know, she's not a dummy, and she's pretty sensitive, and, you know, it was pretty clear, too. And then the man who worked here, he's a redneck cowboy, so, you know, we all, and there was me, and we all have different opinions about life and things, but it was pretty clear that Tom really needed to make sure that foot was the same color as the rest of his body.
Thank you, Gloria. And as we all know, chimpanzees laugh, they cry, they show anger, they grieve, and embrace. And now we're going to play a cut from the CD called Circle the World, which is produced by Dr. Jane Goodall and Dana Lyons. Over to Alan Jensen, and thank you for being on our show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. We really appreciate it, and I'm holding Tom's hand now, and he thanks you too for this opportunity.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
This is the story of Satan and Sprout. One day I was following Satan through the forest, 23 years old, a young male in his prime. He got his name when he was just a kid. He actually stole a manuscript that my mother was writing, and we had to bribe him with a banana to get the chewed remains back again. But that was long ago. And now he's traveling alone, and suddenly he hears ahead of him the sounds of an excited group of chimpanzees feeding, clearly on something delicious. Imagine this with 20 chimpanzees all making the same excited cries. Satan's hair bristles with excitement, and he hastens along the trail and soon comes to a big tree. There's a lot of fruit up there and many chimpanzees feeding. And he swings up the trunk, and he aims for a large bunch of ripe red fruit. There's a younger male feeding there already, but that's okay because Satan is dominant to him. So he approaches, and he makes a arm threat gesture. The young male screams and backs away, and Satan begins to feed. But what Satan didn't realize is that young male's older brother is feeding higher up in the tree. And hearing his kid brother scream, he comes swinging down, and now the two brothers start attacking Satan, and Satan screams. To my amazement, a very ancient female, who was peacefully feeding way up in the canopy, starts swinging down, and she hurls her frail self onto these three battling males, each of whom weighs at least twice as much as she. And with her puny little fist, she begins hitting at the two brothers, who I think are so surprised that they mildly threaten her, and Satan gets away. That was Satan's ancient mother, Sprout, probably at least 50 years old, hair thin, teeth worn down to the gums, but still running to the defense of her great big bully son.
Thank you, John, and thank you, Gloria, for all the wonderful work you do. And I wanted to mention that, yes, they have these chimps in Montreal, and they have radiant heat in the floors, and these chimps, they go out when it's snowing, go look out, they go through a tunnel, can see the snow dropping. They're as mesmerized as humans by the snow, but they don't put their feet into it. Well, we do have a few announcements. And well, tonight, there's Connie Fogel and Bill Krem will be giving a presentation which is part of the series Money, Canadian Sovereignty Under Trade Agreements, Privatization, Globalization. Connie Fogel, tonight at the Friday the 25th at the Mount Pleasant Community Center, 7:30 p.m. And I think I'm going to be going there. Then on Sunday, there will be a showing of two important movies, The Witness and The Emotional World of Farm Animals, at the Pacific Cinematheque, 1 p.m. So if you'd like to have more information, go to www.aroutreach.org/events.htm. That's www.AR, I guess that stands for Animal Rights Outreach.org. Then also we have an event happening with at the West Vancouver Memorial Library at 1950 Marine Drive, where Graham Harrop, who is the cartoonist for the Vancouver Sun, has his work along with John Mython. And this exhibition goes on till November the 30th. John's work became famous in the UK, where his cartoon dog, Claude, was syndicated in the 1960s. And this is John illustrated this in the book called MSing Around. And, of course, MS stands for multiple sclerosis, which is kind of catalogues John's dilemma that he has, that he's a health challenge that he has, and he made cartoons out of it. So there we are. Yes, we have a wonderful letter from Joanne Chang. Oh, John has something. Mm-hmm. John, yeah, we've got about 5 minutes left.
What do you got there?
And I've got to Joanne Chang wrote a letter from the farm sanctuary and telling us about the animals there. And she says, in California, says, I love it here at the farm sanctuary. I've met some truly amazing individuals here, all of whom were destined for the slaughterhouse. And she says to me, you too would really enjoy visiting some of these animals. Let me tell you about my new friends. Wiley is a 60-pound turkey boy. He was obviously bred for meat and not his well-being. He has swollen feet, joint problems, and he's not allowed to mingle with the turkey girls, as he would crush them if he tried to mount them. But despite his problems, he is very loving. Every time I visit Wiley, he would follow me around with his chest straight up against my legs. He loves big hugs and makes happy sounds when I scratch him under his wings. Several times, he's intentionally blocked roosters who tried to attack me. I love Wiley. Turkeys are my favorite animal on the farm. They have so much personality. They're really a lot like dogs. Then there's, she talks about the sheep as well. John, you have something?
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Tamiflu.
Anyway, that's so important. But anyway, thank you, Joanne, for telling us that there's so many stories that you have. Okay, John.
Well, the Food and Drug Administration is investigating reports that the deaths of 12 Japanese children is linked to the antiviral drug Tamiflu. And this possibility has caused alarm since millions of doses of the drug are currently being stockpiled for use in potential flu pandemic, and people are jumping off of roofs. A 14-year-old boy who took a dose of Tamiflu 2 hours later fell from the ninth floor of his apartment building. Another child jumped from the second floor of his house into snow. So it seems as if suicides and also seizures are being reported as side effects from this Tamiflu, which seems to be the only drug in town. And it turns out that, as you probably are aware, not long ago President Bush was instilling panic in this country, in America, by telling people there that a minimum of 200,000 people will die from the avian flu, but it could be as many as 2 million. And this hoax is then used to justify the immediate purchase of 80 million doses of Tamiflu, which is a worthless drug that in no way, shape, or form treats the avian flu, but only decreases the amount of days one is sick, potentially. And that can actually contribute to the virus having more lethal mutations. So the U.S. placed an order for 20 million doses of this worthless drug at a price of $100 a dose. And that comes to a staggering $2 billion. Now, we're told that Roche Pharmaceuticals manufactures Tamiflu, and in a recent New York Times article, they were battling whether or not they would allow generic drug companies to help increase their production. But if you dig further, you'll find that the drug was actually developed by a company called Gilead, that 10 years ago gave Roche the exclusive rights to market and sell Tamiflu. And it turns out that Defense Secretary, or is it Offense Secretary? No, it's Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was made the chairman of Gilead in 1997. Since Rumsfeld holds major portions of stock in Gilead, he will handsomely profit from the scare tactic of the government that's being used to justify the purchase of $2 billion of Tamiflu.
Yes, John.
I'm afraid we have to wrap it up now, so we can't get on to the other article.
What a gift. And, of course, we know that the pharmaceutical industry was a big contributor to the re-election campaign of George Bush. Well, Animal Voices is dedicated to exposing and challenging the terror perpetrated every day by our society against billions of innocent, sentient, non-human animals. So thank you for listening. And our webpage is www.animalvoices.org.